including the U.S. Treasury. And that means that the governments of Western countries have to issue, ultimately will have to issue, large amounts of public debt to support these billion-dollar bailout operations. Okay? The bailout operations, Thailand, Indonesia, and Korea, we're talking about more than $100 billion. Okay? So that these are U.S. dollars. And these are very large amounts of money. But where does the money come from? It comes from the issuing of public debt. And who underwrites the public debt? The speculators. The same Wall Street and European banks which were involved in speculating against the Southeast Asian currencies in the first place and which have become the creditors of these countries. So they are speculators, they are creditors vis-a-vis the countries being bailed out, and they are also the underwriters of public debt in the Western countries which are financing these multi-billion dollar operations. And in that process, the levels of debt have increased beyond bounds, both in the countries under bailout, as well as in the countries which are financing these debts through the issuing of through the normal issuing of public debt, which is then guaranteed by J.P. Morgan's, Solomon Brothers, and so on in Wall Street. So that we're in a circular process where the creditors and the speculators and the underwriters of public debt essentially belong to the same group of institutions. And what has happened is that, first of all, these financial institutions operating in their own name or in the name of their clients have appropriated massive amounts of money wealth, which are the reserves of central banks, and these reserves have been depleted. And then in turn, they have now gone on a shopping spree, buying up high-tech companies in Korea, gas companies in the former Soviet Union at rock-bottom prices. And why? Because they are then called in under the IMF bailout as advisors or consultants in the bankruptcy programs or in the privatization programs, and they are themselves underwriting the sale of assets to foreign investors at rock-bottom prices. Evidently, if the exchange rate has gone down by 60 or 70%, you can buy countries at bargain prices. I'll give you just a few examples. General Electric purchased, I think it was about a year ago, the entire engine production, the largest aircraft engine production facility in the former Soviet Union, which was the provider of engines for the entire, for all civil aviation companies in the former Soviet Union, for a meager $330,000, something which you could buy on your credit card. Okay. Now, and there are numerous cases of buying up. I mean, the United States has bought up the Russian space program for probably a few million dollars. The assets are bought up at rock bottom prices. In some cases, they're given away. In other words, these large investment banks come in, and they ultimately are entrusted with the auctioning of assets, whether they're state enterprises or whether they're private sector enterprises. It doesn't really matter. In turn, they are they demand the closing down. If you look at the Korean bailout, where they list the number of financial institutions that have to be closed down, the same thing in Thailand, they say how many people have to be fired from the public sector, and so on and so forth. In other words, what we are dealing with is an economic program which ultimately destroys the fabric of civil society. and which is engineered at a technical level through a whole series of programs and this, that, and other, and then which is couched in a rhetoric which nobody understands and is presented to us, to people in different countries, as the solution, when in fact it is the cause of economic and social collapse. And indeed, the consensus, what has been called the Washington Consensus on macroeconomic reform, is shared by politicians from one end to the other of the spectrum, from the conservatives to the liberals to the socialists. Everybody, at least within the political establishment, is supporting the neoliberal policy agenda. And in that sense, we have to target, not only target right-wing governments, but so-called leftist governments, who are also protagonists of this type of economic restructuring. Now, I'd like to say something about the Canadian dollar, after having described the process of destabilization of currencies operating in Southeast Asia. And it should be understood that we are dealing with exactly the same financial mechanisms. Speculation against the Korean won or speculation against the Canadian dollar is conducted exactly in the same way in the forward exchange market, using the same speculative instruments and so on. I'd like to illustrate this to you with a small sketch, okay? I have brought... Now, let me tell you what this is. This is the Bank of Canada, okay? Now, in the Bank of Canada, we have stashed some hard currency reserves, okay? Right? Okay, you see them? Does everybody see the dollar bills inside, okay? Now, okay, so these reserves belong to the people of Canada. They're central bank reserves, so they're stashed away. Now, this is in the name of so-called transparency that you can... You can see what's in there. Now, this one is slightly bigger. Now, this I call the big two. It's the two chartered banks here. They have Canadian dollars in them. Okay, they are Canadian, but they are also aspire to become American banks. Okay, so we will say now. What happens when this currency speculation... Now, you see, this bank is stashed with dollar bills. These are the assets of the Canadian chartered banks. It's our money inside there, right? Now, what happens when the Canadian dollar is under attack? It's the same thing as in Korea. Who is speculating against the Canadian dollar? Oh, the Canadian chartered banks, okay? It's the Canadian chartered banks. You ask them, they say, well, no, we do it on behalf of our clients, okay? But what they do is that, I'm not blaming them for doing it because it's part of their business. I think we must understand that is what they're doing, and the government is letting them do it, because they could very well say, no, we have to have a code of conduct. Canadian chartered banks can't speculate against the Canadian dollar. They can speculate against the Korean won. That's not our business, but not against the Canadian dollar. But so these Canadian-American banks, which now are firmly established in the U.S. landscape, and of course with the bank mergers, they will share the Canadian financial landscape with their U.S. counterparts. What they want is to assault the vaults of the Bank of Canada. The Bank of Canada enters into contracts on the forward exchange market to protect its currency, to prevent it from falling. Okay, I don't blame them for doing that. And then what happens is that this money goes here, okay, and that goes okay? This money goes here, and that money goes in here, okay? Now, what the Bank of Canada does is simply to buy back its own currency in exchange for US dollars. Now, what has happened is very serious, because the reserves of the central bank have been depleted. They have been depleted through this process. They have been appropriated in exchange for dollar bills, which the Bank of Canada, in any event, can simply print off. So it's not a very lucrative business to buy back your currency when you can print it in exchange for dollar bills, which are now in the hands of the Canadian chartered banks. Now, the story is not over, because on the 2nd of September, the Bank of Canada renewed what was called it was a $6 billion standby credit facility. It sounds a bit like an IMF thing, okay? It was called a standby credit facility put together by a group of Wall Street banks to lend them $6 billion so that they could then replenish their reserves on borrowed money. So essentially what it means is that this money comes out again and goes back, okay? It goes back, but now it goes back as money which is on loan to the Wall Street syndicated loan. You can consult this. There's been very little press coverage. I understand that it was much larger than $6 billion. I heard the figure of $12 billion, but I wasn't able to check it. We're talking $6 billion US. Of course, that's nearly $10 billion Canadian. It's not a negligible amount. But what it really indicates is the following. It indicates that the Bank of Canada, first of all, is not the lender of last resort as defined in the Banking Act. Okay? These guys are the lenders of last resort. Okay? The American and Canadian banking Wall Street and Bay Street are the lenders of last resort, because they ultimately come to the rescue of the Bank of Canada, lender of last resort, with a bailout in the form of a so-called standby facility. Okay? And the standby facility, I thought, was only used, at least the term was only used for multilateral loan operations, but this is not the case. So what has happened in Canada is very similar to what has happened in South Korea, namely the fact that we have bailed out the central bank on borrowed money. We have a dollar which has lost in value. We have a proposal for the merger in the creation of two of the largest banking institutions, which would swallow up about 70% of the business, but ultimately it is based also on the condition that the whole banking landscape be opened up to foreign banks, which will mainly be U.S. banks. I think two observations should be made. One is that the Bank of Canada no longer exists, okay, as lender of last resort. Not under a situation where it has to borrow money from Wall Street. Okay? Wall Street is the lender of last resort. I checked the Canadian banks, I presume, stood aloof of this rescue operation. It would have been politically too sensitive if the Royal Bank had lent money to the Bank of Canada, but they probably would at some future date. So in other words, the Canadian Central Bank no longer exists. And inasmuch as the tendency is towards the merger of American and Canadian banking, I would suspect we would gradually either become a currency board of types where we have a fixed peg to the US dollar, or alternatively, we might even land up with a dollar, you know, which is equal to 50 cents US. And that may well be the fate of the Canadian bank mergers, because the tendency is towards the integration of the Canadian banking system with that of the United States, and in which case the Bank of Canada would probably become the 13th bank of the Federal Reserve System, what we might call the Reserve Bank of Toronto. Okay? The Federal Reserve Bank of Toronto. Now, all these changes I should conclude rather quickly. I think all these changes have to be understood at a much broader level. In other words, it's important, first of all, that public opinion understand the roles of financial manipulation and how this financial manipulation is conducive to the impoverishment of people all over the world. And I don't think there's a single household in Canada which is not in one way or another affected by this crisis. However, there are no technical solutions. It is not, this system cannot be, I mean, it's not simply a question of saying we have the solutions, we could apply Keynesianism. The thing is that the powerful actors behind this, the system has its logic, the system has to be disarmed in a sense. The legitimacy of those in the seat of political authority has to be questioned, because governments and politicians are increasingly aloof of the interests of citizens, and they are in fact being themselves manipulated by powerful financial interests. And it's not, I don't think it's rhetorical to say that budgets in Ontario or Quebec or federal government are established, carefully negotiated with Wall Street. There is a shuttle diplomacy. It may not operate in such a direct fashion, but there is an understanding that that governments have to conform to the neoliberal agenda, and that creditors ultimately are those who oversee the whole process of economic and social policy. So I think the tasks ahead is essentially to question the legitimacy of those in power and of this neoliberal consensus. We have to disarm this system. We have to question the legitimacy of international agreements such as the MAI. It is not sufficient to simply introduce a few clauses on the environment or labor standards. The agreement is unacceptable, but we also have to be very careful that while that agreement is being negotiated, they have a whole series of backup agreements. There are various initiatives in Washington on the deregulation of capital movements, requiring the amendment of IMF articles, which are being negotiated in parallel. And if one of these, if the MAI doesn't go through, they have their backup. And I think one has to address all these different facets of the system. It is not sufficient simply to start struggling on one issue or another. We have to have an understanding of how this process is evolving in its totality and establish solidarities at the national and international levels. We have to democratize, and this, of course, has been the main thrust of the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform. Is we have to democratize central banks, so that the central banks, the central banks respond to society. This is the process of money creation is instrumental in mobilizing resources. It doesn't create wealth. Money does not create wealth. But it allows to mobilize resources, build schools, hospitals, pay health workers, and so on. And what the creditors are demanding is precisely what they want is to appropriate, and what they have done is to appropriate that process of money creation, which is something which is part of the sovereignty of a nation. We have to start demystifying this system, seeing how it works, restoring and strengthening the local regional economies, questioning the legitimacy of international agreements such as NAFTA, and incidentally, and I'll conclude on that, and it's something to reflect upon. When NAFTA was negotiated between the three presidents, Mulroney, George Bush, and Carlos Salinas, which was a few years ago, it was known to the White House, it was known to the CIA, the FBI, even prior to Carlos Salinas' accession to the presidency, that he was a member of the Mexican drug cartel. They knew that he was a criminal before he became president of Mexico. But nothing was said or mentioned to the fact that that the future president of Mexico was a member of the Mexican drug cartel. On the contrary, they said, that's our man, we need him to sign the North American Free Trade Agreement. And Mulroney knew it, and Bush knew it. And consequently, that we might ask the question or beg the question as to the legitimacy of an agreement which was signed by a known criminal. Today we know he was a known criminal, but there were documents which showed unequivocally that he was a member of the drug cartel before he became president. Thank you very much.